It was as if a completely different President Obama stepped into the debate ring with Mitt Romney last night. They went toe-to-toe on immigration, foreign policy, and the economy. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, our analysts, Dave Peterson of Iowa State University and Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa, will give us their take on the latest face-off, now with two feisty candidates in the ring, and how they think this debate will change the course of the presidential race just 20 days out from Election Day. What is your take on the Obama-Romney rematch? What for you were the most telling moments? Join our conversation after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Fiery, feisty, a couple of the descriptors for last night's debate we've been hearing in our news and in the analysis. We want to do analysis of our own this hour about last night's debate. A little later, we'll check in with IPR's Dean Borg, who is at President Obama's rally this morning in Mount Vernon. But first, we want to check in with analysis, our analysts for the entire hour. Dave Peterson is with us, interim director of the Harkin Institute of Public Policy and professor of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Ben.
Bruce Gronbeck with us by phone, emeritus professor of rhetoric and media studies at the University of Iowa, longtime political watcher. Bruce, now with his domicile in a swing state that happens to be Colorado. Hi, Bruce.
Things are swinging here, yes. Good to talk to you.
Let's talk a little bit about this. We had the left-leaning Huffington Post declare Barack is back in its headline online. Before we talk about the issues, and there are plenty of them to talk about, wind energy, the economy, the treatment of women in our economy, Libya came up, immigration, foreign policy. Before we do that, I'd like to get both of your views on the very different President Obama we saw last night, and your thoughts on candidate Romney. Dave Peterson, we know he was different. Everybody says he was different. How exactly was he different? In what ways?
Well, I think the main difference is that he was much more aggressive. I mean, I had the sense in the first debate that he was almost playing a prevent defense, that they thought the wind was in their sails. They thought as long as there's no news out of the debate, that would be a win for him. And I don't think they expected Romney to be anywhere near as good as he was in the first debate. And so he sort of sat back and let things come to him and let things happen. And it ended up being a mistake, a disaster. And in this time, he was much more engaged. He was much more aggressive at criticizing Mitt Romney. He was much more engaged with the crowd. I think he fed off the crowd very, very well, or the audience very well. And he was more passionate about defending what he's done as president for the last 4 years and trying to make a positive case for why he should be reelected.
River to River listeners, we want you in on this conversation as we dissect the debate last night, the second, the rematch. What did you see or hear in last night's debate that you found remarkable? 1-866-780-9100. Did anything you see or hear change your mind about either candidate? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, our Facebook page is also a venue to us, an avenue towards us. You can tweet us, if you like, at IPR Talk. Anything to add to that, Bruce Gronbeck, about the different candidate Obama we saw last night?
Well, you know, I figured they must have showed him the movie The American President, with Michael Douglas coming out at the end after having hidden quite quietly behind issues and saying it is time to take over and telling his opponent, Bob Rumsfeld, your 15 minutes are over. Mm. It was that kind of transformation, which led to a debate, a set of exchanges that violated the memorandum of understanding that they had, which was that they were not to address each other. Of course they did. And storming around that area, going back and forth, chair to their opponent, to the audience, moving around and interrupting each other. I've seen none of the other town hall debates since the first in 1992 have been that way. This turned it into a wrestling match that we've simply never seen, especially with a sitting president.
So was it the town hall? Of course, maybe a combination of events, Bruce, but what do you think? Do we have an explanation? The town hall setting was different, but do we have an explanation for how it is that we can see such two different Obamas?
Well, I'm sure they trained him very, very differently and worked and pushed on him, set him up to do complete rundowns of his policies. And second, the town hall does allow the candidates to move around and move into an audience that more or less kind of reproduces what they're doing on the campaign trail.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they campaign. I mean, sometimes they're at a distance, but they also wade into crowds. So it brings out, the campaign rhetoric.
Dave Peterson, Mitt Romney, certainly no slouch. Very impressive performance, as he had in the first debate. Wouldn't you agree?
I think more or less, yeah. I think there were some odd word choices that he probably regrets. The binder full of women.
Yes.
The fact that there's a few others. You know, the phrase, I appreciate wind jobs in Iowa is probably not the best phrasing that one could use. He was good, but not anywhere near as good as I think he was the first debate.
Okay. Let's go to our lines are lighted up. We want to get in our conversation with our listeners as much as possible this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Bob is in Waterloo. What did you see last night that you want to tell us about, Bob?
Well, I noticed that Mitt Romney, I thought he did a fantastic job in the debate. I thought President Obama did a nice job as well, much better than the first debate. But Mitt Romney talked about the taxation and how he wouldn't reduce the taxes for the upper income earners. And he's been very clear about that and refuting, I think, what President Romney had said repeatedly. Also, on the women front, he talked about how he had hired so many more women, and I thought that was very clear that, when the audience had asked him about what he would do to try to close the gap on women making 72%, I thought that was a very good point that he said, this is what I have done, and here are the points that I've, these things that I did in order to make that better. I thought that was excellent, and I thought that would be attractive to women voters.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, on education, he talked about how his state was number one when he left office. It's pretty hard to refute when you say that you're going to do something and you do it. And, he did it repeatedly. I thought many, many points that he made well. President Obama defended himself, talked about some of the things that he did well, over the last 4 years. But I was kind of interested, depending upon the programming that you were watching, Fox News, the polls said that Romney won 87-13. And another poll I saw on ABC said that Obama won 66-33. So it certainly was an interesting debate.
Interesting comments. Thank you for your view, Bob, from Waterloo. Let's pick up where Bob mentioned so many points, but let's listen back to some of the comments that were heard last night. For instance, on the economy, much discussion of the economy and taxes as Governor Romney laid out his plan to lower income tax rates while eliminating deductions to pay for it. President Obama took issue with his reluctance to specify which deductions he wants to get rid of.
Now, Governor Romney was a very successful investor. If somebody came to you, Governor, with a plan that said, here, I want to spend $7 or $8 trillion, and we're going to pay for it, but we can't tell you until maybe after the election how we're going to do it, you wouldn't have taken such a sketchy deal, and neither should you, the American people.
But it was the economy that provided some of Governor Romney's strongest moments of the evening when he laid out the difficulties that have plagued the middle class over the past 4 years.
I can tell you that if you were to elect President Obama, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get a repeat of the last 4 years. We just can't afford four more years like the last 4 years. He said that by now we'd have unemployment at 5.4%. The difference between where it is and 5.4% is 9 million Americans without work. I wasn't the one that said 5.4%. This was the president's plan. Didn't get there. He said he would have by now put forward a plan to reform Medicare and Social Security because he pointed out they're on the road to bankruptcy. He would reform them. He'd get that done. He hasn't even made a proposal on either one. He said in his first year he'd put out an immigration plan that would deal with our immigration challenges. Didn't even file it. This is a president who has not been able to do what he said he'd do. He said that he'd cut in half the deficit. He hasn't done that either. In fact, he doubled it. He said that by now, middle-income families would have a reduction in their health insurance premiums by $2,500 a year. It's gone up by $2,500 a year. And if Obamacare is passed or implemented, it's already been passed, if it's implemented fully, it'll be another $2,500 on top. The middle class is getting crushed under the policies of a president who has not understood what it takes to get the economy working again.
Mitt Romney, preceded by President Obama before, talking about the economy. Dave Peterson, the talk about the economy last night. Did either candidate have the upper hand, or they're both good?
No, I thought they were both good on that. I think it was mostly a draw. I think, you know, Romney has an easy case to make that the last 4 years haven't been great. And I think Obama has a relatively easy case to make that Mitt Romney's plans are somewhere between lies and complete obfuscations.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. D is joining us from Rock Island. Hi, D.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing fine. What jumped out at you last night, D?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah, what jumped out at you about the debate last night?
Oh, gosh, there were so many things. And just to name one that really stuck out to me the most has to be the issue with women. Of course, I am a woman, but I'm a single woman, a single African-American black woman struggling to make ends meet. And Barack Obama made me feel that his points were just, he could relate a whole lot more, that they're just more realistic to me. He was raised by a single mother. He watched his grandmother struggle through the years without an education and managed to make it to the top, and that her job was taken away. And of course, you know, I do think education is definitely important. He touched on that in so many areas. And overall, just the economical situation, I don't agree with every move that Barack Obama has made. However, he's been in office for 4 years. He is a little more experienced than Mitt Romney. And to be honest with you, I don't think either one of them can really get us out of the debt. It's going to take a long time. That's a realistic.
Okay. Dee, thank you very much for your viewpoint. We heard from a Romney supporter there, followed by an Obama supporter. We want to reach out to you. How do you think your candidate did last night, either if you're either a Romney or an Obama supporter? Did you see any strengths and any weaknesses there? Let us know what you saw. 1-866-780-9100. Dee finished up there by talking about the economy. Very specific comments last night directed towards Iowa, a windy state, also towards Colorado, Bruce, we heard last night, windy state, both swing states as well. When the debate turned to energy policy, whether gas prices for the American people should be what the president uses to gauge the success of energy policy, Governor Romney laid out his plan to rely on all sources of energy in the U.S.
The right course for America is to have a true all-of-the-above policy. I don't think anyone really believes that you're a person who's going to be pushing for oil and gas and coal. You'll get your chance in a moment. I'm still speaking.
Well,
the answer is I don't believe people think that's the case that wasn't a question.
Okay.
That was a statement. I don't think the American people believe that. I will fight for oil, coal, and natural gas. And the proof of whether a strategy is working or not is what the price is that you're paying at the pump. If you're paying less than you paid a year or two ago, why then the strategy is working.
President Obama agreed that all sources of U.S. energy should be tapped, but pointed out a difference between himself and the governor on the issue of the wind energy tax credit.
So I'm all for pipelines. I'm all for oil production. What I'm not for is us ignoring the other half of the equation. So, for example, on wind energy, when Governor Romney says these are imaginary jobs, when you've got thousands of people right now in Iowa, right now in Colorado, who are working, creating wind power with good-paying manufacturing jobs, and the Republican senator in Iowa is all for it, providing tax credits to help this work, and Governor Romney says, I'm opposed. I'd get rid of it. That's not an energy strategy for the future, and we need to win that future.
Dave Peterson, you're in Iowa. Bruce Gronbeck, you're in Colorado. Those two states mentioned. Dave Peterson, how important, how big an issue is it in this swing state is the issue of wind energy? Is that something that's going to perhaps tip the balance?
You know, I'm really surprised that the president hasn't made a bigger deal out of that. You see so many ads in Iowa. I'm surprised there's not a specific wind energy ad in Iowa. That this is, you know, the wind energy industry is reliant on the production tax credit and the federal legislation that enables and provides some support for the wind industry. And we've got 6,000 jobs in this state that are, you know, run the gamut of manufacturing, of maintaining these windmills that we see up and down I-35 and in northwest Iowa. And this is a single piece of federal legislation that is essential to this policy, or excuse me, to this industry going forward in this state. And the two candidates have starkly different views on it. I mean, Obama's in favor of the production tax credit. Romney's opposed to it.
And we have a Republican governor who is in favor of it.
Oh, it's to give you a sense that this isn't just a sort of liberal conservative thing. Steve King's in favor of this. You know, Terry Branstad's in favor of this. Chuck Grassley's in favor of this. Every Republican from the state who serves in Congress is in favor of it. Our governor has taken Governor Romney to task for not supporting this. And I was sitting there last night wondering, is he going to actually, you know, mention it this time? And you know, for an Iowan, I'm glad he did.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, out there in Colorado, how does wind energy, alternative energy play out there? Is it something that could swing a lot of voters?
Well, oddly, the battle in Colorado is not over wind or even solar energy. This state is very, very happy because it is manufacturing an awful lot of wind turbines and has moved into the solar area very strong. The fight in Colorado, of course, is over fracking. This is a big fracking state, and so the whole issue of natural gas and oil and oil production is the central issue. With a battle between a series of communities, my own included, actually, that said they want no fracking inside city limits, and a commission and being sued by a commission that Governor Hickenlooper set up to study this issue. So the hot issue is fracking. The wind issue, it just sits back just hangs around because it's so important to manufacturing right now.
Aaron is tweeting us. He said he thought that President Obama's comment on low-skill manufacturing is not – that it's not coming back to the U.S. was refreshingly honest. Now, I wonder Dave, are voters ready to hear that the low-tech manufacturing is a thing of the past?
No. I mean, I don't think voters, as a general rule, aren't ready to hear most stark realities or negative realities.
Go back to Walter Mondale
for that,
right?
Yeah, we're both going to raise your taxes. I'm the only one who's going to be honest about it. Yeah, you know, no, I don't think voters want to hear that. I mean, to a certain extent, candidates have a tendency to pander, have a tendency to tell us what they think we want to hear. And this was something that was, you know, maybe refreshingly honest.
Okay, let's try to fit in a call or two before we have to take a short break. Dave in Urbandale. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you today?
We're doing fine.
Well, I thought the debate last night was pretty much a draw. Mm-hmm. I'm an Obama supporter, but at the same time, I couldn't understand why Obama or the Democrats in general don't challenge the $5 trillion reduction in government on the basis of the numbers of people it will put out of work. If you shrink government, the only thing you shrink really is people, because government doesn't produce a product.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many jobs would be $5 trillion, but those people are very smart people, and they would come into the job marketplace, and they would compete with everyone else. So I think that Obama missed a great opportunity last night to maybe tilt the wind in his favor.
Okay, good. Nice imagery, too. Dave in Urbandale. What about that? Bruce Gronbeck, why wouldn't the Democrats go out there and say, you know, government does create jobs, and we've lost a lot of jobs, and we could lose many more jobs with drastic cutbacks?
Well, of course, one thing that is very hard for the Democrats to handle is the question of of government-supported jobs. And some of those, and a lot of them, are going to be government-supported jobs. Certainly not all of them, but many are. And the people who will go and compete probably will be in areas like into the private sector, will be in areas like medicine and social services, where there has been a lot of money that would be cut by Romney worry president. And I think those become hard for them to deal with. And I suspect as well, they might be thinking that those constituencies are pretty well settled in who they're going to vote for. And the fight, as you can see, really at this point is most heavily over the Latino vote and the women vote. The women's vote has been sliding around a little in the last couple of weeks, and I think that is the one that was particularly important. So I think they want to keep that charge, the general charge, growing, the sketchy deal, as it was called last night, going at that level, because they're pretty sure they've got that issue in good shape. They want to go after other constituencies too. So I think they're both in the constituency issue and the issue of government employees.
One of our listeners, Tammy, writes, and she wants to comment on that, what you were talking about there, Bruce, the women's issues. She writes, "I was surprised by Romney's many unguarded revelations of how out of touch he is with most Americans. He promised that, quote, every middle-income taxpayer no longer will pay any tax on interest, dividends, or capital gains. Apparently, goes on Tammy, unaware how little income these three categories yield to most middle-income taxpayers. And it was ironic that in addressing guns, Tammy writes, he mentioned that in addressing guns that children should have two parents at home, yet he does not want to ensure that young women have the ability to avoid being single parents by accessing birth control." So on that, of course, before we leave in a minute or so, Dave Peterson, did you see a winner there in terms of gaining the women's vote?
Oh, no, I think Obama was the clear winner in dealing with the women's vote. You know, and I think it's going to continue. The idea of, you know, one of the people earlier, one of the callers, I forget his name, had talked about, you know, when Romney, the story about when Romney was governor of Massachusetts, that he found that he hired all these women. And at some level, I know that that's a nice story. But A, we're finding out that the binder full of women that he asked for, in fact, was prepared before he was elected for whoever the governor was going to be and was given to him, not that he, you know, proactively sought it out. And B, the idea that a man who had run the Olympics, had run companies, had been 2 degrees from Harvard, couldn't think of any qualified women on his own was stunning. And again, was sort of in like the caller said, or excuse me, the emailer had said, you know, this idea of out of touch and sort of inability to relate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to come back in just a minute. And we've talked so much about binders full of women. We are going to hear that cut in the second half hour and talk about it a little bit. Is this a fair criticism of Romney, or do you think perhaps the media is picking on a phrase that was turned in a live debate, let's face it? 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, a short conversation with Dean Borg. Dean Borg in Mount Vernon at Cornell College, where the president is, back in Iowa. We think he's just finishing up speaking. We'll hear about it from Dean Borg. More from you. Reaction to the second of the debates between Mitt Romney, Governor Mitt Romney, and President Obama. Your thoughts, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. 20 days away from the election, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow at this time, oh, you'll be interested in this. I sure am. The Atlantic named him one of the 100 most influential figures in American history. Tomorrow on this hour, my guest is political activist and six-time presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Tomorrow on this program. Today, Politics Wednesday, dissecting last night the second of three debates between President Obama and Governor Romney. Their face-off being dissected by Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa, Dave Peterson of Iowa State University, and we loving your comments as well. 1-866-780-9100. We want to get back to more analysis of that, but let's first go to Dean Borg, the president, that debate taking place on the East Coast, but the president today in the Midwest here, students and others eager to see the president campaigning in Iowa today, lined up around the block at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Many students even camped out last night to see the president. The event was moved inside the Cornell College Fieldhouse because of possible rain this morning. I believe the president has just finished speaking at the rally, and Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg is with us. Dean, is it over?
No, it's not over, Ben. We expected it would be over by this time, but because of the overflow crowd, about 800 in the lower level of the Cornell Fieldhouse, the president stopped by there and spent several minutes, I'd say 10 to 15 minutes at least, talking with them before he moved upstairs to where there's some 2,000 people sat in the field house, and he's still speaking. He started about 12:15. I must say that the enthusiasm of the president is matched by, even before he arrived, the people who are waited in line and are standing here now.
Okay, very good. So when you compare this, and you did cover the run-up to the caucuses in 2008, Obama's dramatic rise here in Iowa, the enthusiasm in that general election campaign 4 years ago, worries this time about an enthusiasm gap? You sense some of that same enthusiasm.
I sense today that I'm seeing the type of enthusiasm I saw in 2008 and during the caucus campaign when he was running for the nomination, and then the later campaign when he was actually the candidate. In fact, Bruce Braley spoke here before the president spoke, and Congressman Braley said that he, during a tweet last night in the debate, he said, "This is the Barack Obama I remember from 2008. And that's the same thing I'm sensing here, Ben, today. I saw it out in the line of the people who were lined up at 6 a.m. this morning when I first arrived here at the field house. And I'm sensing it in this crowd and in the way that Barack Obama is connecting with them. It's reminiscent of 2008.
Dean Borg, thank you very much. We'll be looking forward to your reports later today, also on All Things Considered. Dean Borg, live from the Cornell College Fieldhouse in Mount Vernon. Thank you, Dean. Let's go to you, Bruce. After hearing that, I wonder if we can compare how much time President Obama has spent in Iowa versus Colorado, both swing states, right? He's been out there as much?
I think so. You know, we'll see those totals after the election. They always get published. But this much I can say, while Obama's in Iowa, Biden is in Colorado. He had two events today, I know, and he had to miss one yesterday. But other than that, so they are pounding Colorado. Colorado, like Iowa, was quite a close state in the last election. It is swinging freely right now, they are coming here hard. Obviously, of course, the big prizes for both the candidates are places like Florida, Ohio, Virginia, North Carolina, that have many more electoral voters in them. Florida's the biggest with 29 to go.
And I believe that's leaning, yeah, in the last polls, leaning Romney in most polls, isn't it?
It has been, right. But it's tight enough so that the Democrats still keep hoping and hoping and hoping. Yeah. After all, they thought Gore won it in 2000. So, those are the prizes. But most of the calculations of Obama's chances of winning do not involve Florida. Yeah.
Dave, I want to ask you about an event tomorrow where you are in Ames. No more heavyweight in music than Bruce Springsteen. He's coming to perform in this so-called campus takeover tomorrow at ISU. That can ramp up the atmosphere, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's I have to admit, I got my tickets yesterday. and it wouldn't have mattered who the candidate was, right? It could have been Obama. It could have been Romney, Gary Johnson. Even your guest tomorrow, Ralph Nader. If it was Springsteen was coming to play in favor of Ralph Nader, I would have been there.
I'll ask him tomorrow.
Okay, yeah. And, I will say the line, I think, had three people under the age of 40 in it. So it wasn't I'm not sure. You know, Springsteen's huge. He's wonderful. I'm really looking forward to it. You know, I don't know how well he'll reach out to college students as much as he will to, you know, me. But I think it'll be a big deal. I think it'll be exciting. So.
Okay, let's get back to some phones in a moment. But to the the most often mentioned comment from the debate last night, at least in our discussion so far, and in a lot of media reports, a question about pay equity for women in last night's debate brought about one of the more talked about moments of that night when Governor Romney told a story about trying to recruit women to his cabinet while serving as governor of Massachusetts. Let's listen.
And I went to my staff and I said, how come all the people for these jobs are all men? They said, well, these are the people that have the qualifications. And I said, well, gosh, can't we find some women that are also qualified? And so we took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
Binders full of women. Within an hour following the debate last night, the Facebook page, Binders Full of Women, received over 90,000 likes. This morning, well, it's probably gone over 300,000 by now, close to 300,000, if not over. Let's talk about the social media of this, Bruce. Within minutes, phrases like Big Bird from the last debate, Binders Full of Women in this debate. How does the social media lightning strike, if I can put it that way, change a campaign?
Well, it certainly changed my life. And my wife's very own Facebook page says I spent the morning looking all through my office for Binders Full of Women. So it's flying everywhere. That's one of the issues that actually I spent some time studying after the last presidential election. And it is obvious that first Facebook, before that, others, but Facebook and now Twitter have allowed a dialogue to be circulating underneath the hard news kinds of channels that keep people building their own understandings of the world, their own constructions, their own evaluations, and those are going so far and fast as to now becoming major news items. Certainly, for example, that's exactly where PBS started its commentary. The first people it asked about who won or who scored in the debate were those keeping track of Facebook and Twitter, so that we not only have the talk going underneath the news media, but they're becoming news itself. And so all that attempt to do what you just did and count the number of hits and decide what's influential or not, this is a whole different game in the political system the latest evolution in digital politics, and it makes it tremendously exciting. It becomes diverting, I'm sure, for the candidates in some ways, because it tends to deal with phrase making or misspeaking, but it doesn't matter because it puts the emphasis on candidates' positive and negative characteristics.
Such a far cry from generations ago when candidates traveled from East Coast to West on the rails, and perhaps, you know, you didn't hear what the news had been 2 days ago from these candidates until much later, if you heard it at all. Beth in Coralville chimes in. She writes, as a female who has seen inequality, what I heard, and ironically, so did my 15-year-old daughter, was that the solution to equal pay lies with having a robust economy that will produce so many jobs that employers will be so anxious to get good workers, they're going to be anxious to hire women. So that is what we have fought for, asks Beth in Coralville. Carrie writes, as a woman, I would hate to find out last night that Romney hired me because I was a qualified woman instead of just from my qualifications alone. I do demand equality as a female. Sometimes that means I still have to lose. If there are 30 men more qualified than myself, I would not feel as proud to know that I was hired because of all the women. I was the most qualified. That from Carrie. Thank you very much for that. Let's go back to the phones. Aaron is with us from Dubuque. Hi, Aaron. Aaron, are you there?
I am. Yes.
Yeah, we hear you. A little cloudy, but try again, please.
Okay. You know, one of the things that
found interesting as I've watched the last three debates is our format, and it's really been this way over the last several elections. We require this degree of civility and willingness to follow rules that we're seeing rapidly leave our culture. So, you know, if we're not going to require our candidates to follow rules or allow our moderators to actually have the ability to perhaps, say, cut off a mic, maybe we should just let it be a free-for-all, you know, just as opposed to watching candidates step on what one another say and blatantly call one another liars one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that absolutely strikes me is it amazes me that the confidence in the current administration on an economic level is so low, because everywhere you look, doesn't matter who they say won the debate, they say that Romney wins from an economic standpoint. People are more confident in him from an economic standpoint. And it amazes me that, trust me, I'm a businessman, is enough of a statement to garner economic votes, or the economic vote, as opposed to looking at history, looking at the creation of jobs and the challenges that were faced over the last 4 years. So that just baffles me. But watching the debates is like watching an episode of Whose Line Anyway. It's like,
okay.
Winners or losers are arbitrary.
A nice observation. Aaron, let's throw that out to our analysts. A lack of civility? What is a proper amount of civility here? We do want to know where the disagreements are, don't we, Dave Peterson?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, keep in mind that these rules that we have in these debates, the formal rules, are things that are worked out between the campaigns. And the most part, I think they're the most tepid, defensive sets of rules to keep anything interesting from happening. And as the moderator pointed out, right, she never signed that agreement. She wasn't bound by any rules. She could do whatever she wanted. I think Jim Lehrer, the same way, you know, in the first debate, threw the rules out the window and allowed the candidates to have a free-flowing exchange of ideas. And honestly, I think the two presidential debates we've seen this round have been more informative, have been more useful in many ways than any debates I can remember.
Dave in Cedar Rapids, not you, Dave, but Dave in Cedar Rapids, one of our listeners, writes, I have noticed that hindsight, conventional wisdom, and inertia have magnified Obama's muted performance in the first debate. Commentators suggested debate number one was disastrous for him. I think this conventional wisdom drove the aggressive behavior in the town hall during the second debate. I don't think uncivil discourse and interrupting makes a better candidate. But now President Obama is being credited for being more spirited, a more spirited debater. That's code for a boxing match. This horse race or boxing match metaphor is low-hanging fruit for two-minute sound bites, news stories, but it doesn't make politics better in this country. It makes them worse. The view from Dave in Cedar Rapids. What do you think about this type of debate, what you saw last night, Bruce? Good for our democracy, or simply a boxing match for the masses to entertain them?
Well, it certainly is capturing the general political culture over the last 3, 4, 5 years. The high partisanship, the strident voices. It is odd to see somebody coming in, you know, getting in a president's face, sitting president's face, pointing his finger at him, and addressing him very directly like that. That simply hasn't been happening until this set of debates.
But it is it is after all a governor doing it.
It is. They usually do it in his office, though.
But more
generally, I think in the television age, we began, as was happening last night all over the place, talking about style and substance and separating them. And once you do that, and once you give the question or matter of style that kind of emphasis, then how somebody looks, how they sound, what they wear, do their clothes fit, ask Mr. Nixon, all those kinds of questions somehow now are becoming very important to the outcome of elections. When Harry Truman was riding on the back of those trains you were talking about earlier, you didn't get that close. And those kinds of things simply didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Now they do. The television age centralized a bigger than life celebrityhood for even our presidents, and that just has slowly evolved into the political culture of today, where that means who can be rough and tough, who can draw fastest, who can bring down who can bring down the villain. It's amazing.
Let's talk a little bit before we have to go for this hour, Bruce and Dave, about the performance of the moderator, CNN's Candy Crowley, in moderating. It's worth mentioning she was the first woman to moderate a presidential debate since Carol Simpson back in 1992. Crowley played a more active role than the campaigns had anticipated, as we mentioned earlier, in posing follow-up questions to those posed by members of the studio audience in this town hall-style format. And the most controversial moment we want to listen to right now came when she drew on her own experience covering the attack on the Libyan embassy in Benghazi, which resulted in the deaths of four Americans. Here's the exchange, starting with the president, asserting that his administration was quick to call the attack an act of terror.
The day after the attack, Governor, I stood in the Rose Garden and I told the American people and the world that we are going to find out exactly what happened, that this was an act of terror, and I also said that we're going to hunt down those who committed this crime. And then a few days later, I was there greeting the caskets coming into Andrews Air Force Base and grieving with the families. And the suggestion that anybody in my team, whether Secretary of State, our UN ambassador, anybody on my team, would play politics or mislead when we've lost four of our own, Governor, is offensive. That's not what we do. That's not what I do as president. That's not what I do as commander-in-chief.
Governor, if you want to reply quickly, please.
I think it's interesting. The president just said something which is that on the day after the attack, he went to the Rose Garden and said that this was an act of terror.
That's what I said.
You said in the Rose Garden, the day after the attack, it was an act of terror. It was not a spontaneous demonstration. Is that what you're saying?
Please proceed, Governor.
I want to make sure we get that for the record, because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror.
Get the transcript.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of terror.
Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
He did call it an act of terror. It did as well take 2 weeks or so for the whole idea of there being a riot out there about this tape to come out. You're correct about that.
The administration indicated that this was a reaction to a video and was a spontaneous reaction. It took them a long time to say this was a terrorist act by a terrorist group.
Okay, a long exchange. We wanted to play it all just to get the sense of the tension in that discussion between the three of them. So many things we could talk about in listening to this, but let's talk about Candy Crowley. What marks do you give her? We've got a couple minutes left before we have to end the hour, for her performance as a moderator. Dave Peterson, was that an appropriate role for her to play?
I think so. I mean, I think she was... I hate to say it, but I think she threw Mitt Romney a lifeline at that moment that, you know, it was pretty clear from the body language of President Obama that he understood that Mitt Romney was completely and utterly wrong in his statement and the please proceed, Governor line. Right?
We're in a courtroom, aren't we?
He sat back down, right? He got up and then he sat back down and said, please proceed. And he was going to give him as much rope as he wanted to hang himself, and that was going to be, and he was just going to let Romney go. And knowing, and you knew, and I know he had an answer ready for it. And so when she cut him off, I think it made a nice moment, and I think it is something that's getting played a lot today. But I think that could have gone actually much, much worse for Romney.
Had he had more time with the rope?
Yes.
Bruce, we have about a minute left. Your thoughts before we have to say goodbye on that.
Yeah, well, I think she did try to control the debate more than Jim Lehrer did by get more questions in. Although the critique that I see flying around on the internet right now is that she chose questions that were good for Obama more so than for Romney. Women's rights, outsourcing, Romney's tax plan. Libya, how are you different from the Bush administration? So that she was feeding him. That may or may not be true. I mean, but anyway, so she has become a controversial figure. And yet I think everybody, as I listened to it last night, agreed that she also let the debate become much more not only exciting, but even informative, and that's a good thing.
There's a joke going around this last week that I mentioned earlier among journalists. This presidential debate is the most important one since the last one, or until the next one. That next one is next Monday. Will that be even more important than this one, or have we seen the peak there? Dave, quickly, a word from you.
I think we've seen the peak. I mean, the next one's about foreign policy, and generally speaking, voters are less interested in foreign policy than they are in domestic policy, so it'll probably have less of an impact.
Okay, thank you very much. Dave Peterson, Bruce Gronbeck, we have to go. Sorry to all the callers and emails. We didn't get on a lot of participation this hour. We can only handle so much. Time has a way of treating us that way when we only have an hour. Thank you. So much, Dave and Bruce, and our callers and emailers. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Catherine Perkins. Catherine is the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows. Thanks to Jason Burns in Ames, or Garrett Van Leeuwen, excuse me. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.